Professor Mark Kleiman, should we introduce ourselves?
Let's do that, John McWhorter. I'm Mark Kleiman. I teach at UCLA.
And I am John McWhorter. I teach as an adjunct at Columbia in linguistics and Western Civilization and American Studies. And we are here today to talk about the drug war, right?
The drug war and the things that happen even without the drug war.
That's right. And specifically, you have a new book out with Oxford, a great press, and it's called Drugs and Drug Policy, What Everyone Needs to Know.
Yes.
And I guess we could kick off with a question that I want to ask as somebody who has been very concerned with the drug war in a lot of my writing over the past 2 or 3 years in particular. And I worry that the drug war has had a much more direct effect upon just about everything that worries us about the race situation in America than most people are aware. And I noticed that your subtitle is What Everyone Needs to Know. And maybe you could begin by telling the Blogging Heads audience what it is that you deign to suppose it is that everyone needs to know that they don't know already.
Yes, it does go on my list of top 10 arrogant titles. And I'm pleased to say it wasn't mine. It's the running subtitle of an Oxford series.
Huh. I didn't know that.
And they called me and said, "Do you want to play this game?"
So yours is one of many entries.
One of many.
Okay.
The notion is to provide the information that's common currency among scholars in an area,
mm-hmm.
In a format available to, as they said to me, the readers of the New Yorker.
Mm-hmm.
So the notion is not to break new academic ground, but to provide a common basis of understanding for discussing an issue.
Mm-hmm. And especially facts that may not be immediately apparent to that New Yorker crowd.
Right. And as we wrote it, I had two co-authors, Jonathan Calkins of Carnegie Mellon and Angela Hawken of Pepperdine. It was an interesting process because we don't have the same views. And it turns out in doing Schottling work, that mostly doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
And in doing this kind of work, it mattered quite a lot. So mm-hmm. we had some fairly serious arguments. And I think we would all say at this point that what we really figured out was not what people need to know, mm-hmm. but what people need to be disabused of. I think it was Will Rogers who said that it's not what you don't know that hurts you.
Mm-hmm.
It's what you know that ain't so.
Exactly.
And most of the stuff that people know, and I'm not talking about the average newspaper reader. I'm talking about people making important decisions in government.
Mm-hmm.
Most of what they know about drugs is just wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Starting with the fact that if I asked you whether, pick your favorite politician, use drugs,
right?
You'd probably say, well, not that I know of,
mm-hmm.
even if you'd seen him drinking.
Right.
So the number one drug is excluded from discussions of drug policy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, number one in how many people use it, how many people are addicted to it,
mm-hmm.
how many people it kills, how much crime it causes, how many people are in prison as a result of it.
Mm-hmm.
Alcohol is number one on all of those lists. And yet you can talk about this drug policy from here to next week, and people won't mention alcohol.
Certainly. And that's actually one aspect of the book that is counterintuitive. One picks it up, and if one has even a basic familiarity with statements of yours in the media and the place that you occupy in that general Rolodex, if we want to call it that, you pick up Drugs and Drug Policy and one expects a take on drug legalization that will be, for one thing, largely in favor of it, maybe with hedgings, but the idea being that you would be, quote-unquote, on the side of the angels, which I think you are. But one expects a certain something, and one certainly wouldn't expect as much coverage as you give in the book to alcohol. There's certainly a sense, I think, among people in government as well as this New Yorker crowd who are probably drinking wine, that alcohol abuse is something separate from talking about drug abuse with cocaine right. and heroin, and you seem to disagree with that.
Right. Well, the first thing I have to say is, would some power the gift to give us to see ourselves as others see us?
Mm-hmm.
I am stunned to hear that there's a part of the world in which I'm thought of as being sort of vaguely on the legalizer side
mm-hmm.
of the drug issue. I don't think that's the way I'm perceived by most of the people inside the debate.
Mm-hmm.
I think some of the drug warriors see me that way, but mm-hmm. but most of the anti-prohibition crowd does not regard me as a friend. But you're right. I mean, I sort of culturally look as if I ought to be. I mean, if you knew everything else about me except what I do academically,
exactly.
Yeah, you would guess I was sort of on that side of the debate because that's where respectable people and economics professors and law professors are.
That's precisely what I mean. Yeah. And nevertheless, that's not the case. And one of the most striking things that I think comes out of the book, actually, is you're saying that indications are that if drug, not only drug possession, but drug sales were legalized, that it's not the case that we have no reason to expect addiction to go up. It's often thought, I think it's a piety, and I must say that I have espoused it at times myself, that if we legalized sale, perhaps if we put it in the hands of the government, but in general, if people did not go to prison anymore for selling even hard drugs, it's often thought that it's alarmist to suppose that there would be an epidemic of addiction in society, and often it's thought that an example of that is Portugal, where the drug war has been relaxed, by no means eliminated, but relaxed, and it's thought that everything has been completely hunky-dory there, and that there has been no uptick in addiction. And it's thought that there must be other statistics showing that there would not be an uptick in addiction. And in fact, you show with your co-authors in the book that there's no reason to suppose that we would not have an uptick in addiction, and maybe there addiction, that there's a lot of reason to suppose that we would.
If it were merely an uptick rather than a surge,
mm-hmm.
that would violate everything we know about human behavior.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you'd have to repeal basic economics not to have a very large increase in cocaine consumption if cocaine were an ordinary commodity.
Mm-hmm. And even if we had in society a campaign that made the use of these drugs as uncool, so to speak, as cigarette smoking is being made to seem among many generations. That doesn't mean that smoking is not happening, but that there's been a major change in how smoking is perceived since the era of the television show Mad Men, for example. But your idea is that that couldn't counteract just the basic human nature and the low price that would be involved.
No, I think it couldn't, and I think the evidence for tobacco is that the uncoolness has been somewhat secondary to price increases.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to me the big driver. There's no doubt that with respect to tobacco, there was lots of very bad stuff about tobacco smoking that people really didn't know. And that a 40-year campaign of both making it unfashionable but also convincing people it was really, really, really bad for them
mm-hmm.
has had an impact.
Mm-hmm.
But with cocaine, we're starting from the other corner. Most of the population is terrified of cocaine.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard to imagine that legal cocaine would have a worse reputation than illegal cocaine.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that just seems to me like wishful thinking.
Right.
And there's a lot of that going around in the drug policy debate.
Mm-hmm.
And then from both sides.
There was the point that you made about the fact that if an industry is going to make a profit and or continue, then they have to hook the serious, heavy addicts as opposed to the casual people. And that therefore, if you had legalized sale of, say, cocaine and heroin, then there would be an incentive to keep those really problem users addicted in the same way as that seems to be true of alcohol today. Do I have the argument on that?
Exactly right. An industry, whether licit or illicit, that sells an addictive commodity
mm-hmm.
is as dependent on its addicted users as they are on the drug.
Mm-hmm.
It can't get by selling to non-addicted users unless you're dealing with something like, you know, old single malt scotch.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at $60 a bottle, you can make a profit on people who drink a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But Budweiser is not in business to serve the guy who has, you know, a beer every Saturday night.
Right. Right.
When I was growing up in Baltimore, there was a local brand of cheap beer, and the TV ad for it was the beer that real beer drinkers prefer. And real beer drinker was defined as somebody who drank a case or more of beer a week.
Right.
Yep, that's the brewer you want to be. You want to be the brewer that real beer drinkers drink.
Sure, sure. And so that would be something we'd have to think about in terms of
sure
an incentive for...
I mean, the argument for state monopoly, it seems to me, is actually very strong
mm-hmm.
with respect to most vices.
Mm-hmm.
But what we see in the case of gambling is that when we went from the numbers game to the state lottery, the state was far more shameless in its marketing and its attempt to develop addicted gamblers than the numbers operators had ever been. So that, you know, I'm old enough to remember that debate, and it was perfectly obvious that the numbers game was pretty harmless. People would lose a quarter or a dollar a day, no big deal. And why give all that money to criminals if people wanted to gamble in that way? Why not let the state make some money off it? And, you know, the state lotteries were a disgrace.
Right. Seedy.
And didn't even give any more money to schools, as it turned out.
No, that never... That,
that never worked out.
This, see, you... Everything that you're saying about drug legalization and its pitfalls makes a perfect kind of sense. I completely understand where you're coming from. And one follows the argument in the book, and one comes to the end where you have a chapter, conclusion, what is to be done. And in terms of the what we might call this New Yorker crowd who have a spontaneous sense that there should be some sort of drug legalization, it seems that one of the only entries that would make that crowd cheer is where you have, among various suggestions on what you call the pragmatist list of suggestions, among three that you give, but the one that I think many people would be most interested in was the pragmatist list, what could actually be done. You have, it's number three, reduce the number of drug dealers behind bars. And you say locking up a typical drug dealer creates an empty niche in the market for a new dealer to occupy. We could halve, there's a word that doesn't work orally, cut in half the number of dealers in prison. In the United States, nearly 500,000 at any one time, without making drugs noticeably cheaper or easier to get. And then you say cutting back incarceration for run-of-the-mill dealers would make room for authority to concentrate greater enforcement and punishment on the dealers responsible for the most violence and disorder. And there you go, and that's certainly true. We're talking about cutting in half. And all of that makes perfect sense, but it seems to me, what I can't help thinking is that there's an aspect of this, which you certainly mention in the book and many times, which is that the war on drugs, as it's currently run, destroys poor black communities in a way that I don't think people are always aware of, because it's getting to the point where the only people who knew what a poor black community was like before about 1970, in a really living way, are getting to the point where they're quite elderly. That was a very long time ago.
Right.
And so I think that people today think of the way a typical black ghetto is now as just the way it always has to have been, that 100 years ago it must have been basically the same thing in terms of levels of violence, in terms of how many people had fathers who took care of them, in terms of how many people had a basically 40-hour a week work, and et cetera. And it seems to me, it's something that I've often argued, is that when you have a situation where the police are responsible for trawling through poor black communities where there is the open-air drug selling, which, as you say in the book, is disproportionately minority, and I think really black and Latino, if the police are responsible for that, then of course you're going to have a situation where, for one thing, generations grow up thinking of the police as an enemy. And because that's often the only white people they really ever interact with in a real way, they end up thinking of white people as an enemy. And if there is this black market that is always tempting when job opportunities aren't the easiest to get and aren't the most promising, then it means that you have generation after generation who think of legal work as an option, and plenty of people do it, but then there are a critical mass of people who end up taking this black market route and probably either going to prison for a long time or being killed after having produced children who then grow up without a father. And this just goes around and around and around. The violence, the joblessness, the fatherlessness passed on generation after generation. And sorry to talk for so long. I'm done very quickly.
No.
But I think that if you took away...
If you'd said anything I didn't agree with, I would have interrupted.
Good. Okay. If you take away the war on drugs, I've often said, then you would pull the crucial card out of that whole card house. And poor black communities wouldn't be paradise by any means, but the idea, and this is always hard to say, but unfortunately I think it's a genuine take on what's going on, the idea that for a young black man with only a high school education, or maybe less, is only optionally responsible for getting legal work, and that then there's this other thing that he might do. Once that was not the case, you'd have a whole new world. These men would get jobs because they're as resilient as all human beings are, and the jobs wouldn't be as CEOs, no, it wouldn't be as middle managers, but anything that they did, anything, stocking shelves, would be better than what they do now.
Right.
And I read your book and I think, yes, 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 indeed, all of these are facts, but wouldn't it maybe be worth it to try out legalization of these drugs under some arrangement in order to save Black America if we feel that race is a massive rift in this country that we haven't completely gotten past?
Right.
And that's my question for you.
Right. Okay. Requires a somewhat extended answer.
Sure.
I completely agree. Well, sorry. I 90% agree with the premise. I don't know to what extent people deprived of the opportunity to make an illegal dollar by selling crack would instead make the same illegal dollar by boosting cars. Agree. The revenue isn't the same. But there certainly would be changes. Not clear to me how big the change would be. We shouldn't underestimate the impact on that same neighborhood of having anybody who gets a little money in his pocket using it on cocaine. I mean, think about the nightmare that alcohol is in those very same neighborhoods. And people imagine that cocaine would be instead of alcohol. I'm sure that's wrong. I think the cocaine problem would increase the alcohol problem and be in addition to it. So all of that is right. If I thought our current drug war was the only alternative to legalization, and if, and I do, as you do, give priority to the needs of those neighborhoods, then it seems to me legalization would be a reasonable thing to do. Sorry, a reasonable thing to be for. Then you and I would confront the fact that you can't do it because a policy that's possibly quite useful to 7% of the population, and certainly very harmful to 80% of the population, is not going to pass. I mean, even if you didn't have the specific fact about race. So then we'd just be frustrated by having a good policy idea we couldn't.
In terms of what could be lobbied and what could actually.
Right.
Okay.
If I thought that we could try it and go back to the status quo if it didn't work, then there's enough uncertainty in the world, I'd say, sure, let's try it. I'm sure that's wrong. This is a trapdoor policy. As we discovered with alcohol, once there's a mass market, going back and trying to re-illegalize something is a fool's errand. The only circumstance under which we'd want to re-illegalize, if I can make up a word, cocaine, is if we'd had a tripling in consumption. Anything less than that would count as victory.
Right.
So now try to imagine drug law enforcement.
I think you say double in the book. I think you say double in the book.
But that was a compromise.
Oh. Okay.
I would be much more willing to accept a big hit on the public health end with more drug abuse.
Well, that's interesting. Okay.
To get crime down.
Okay.
I mean, crime is my number one concern. And again, that's not unlinked to the race thing. You know, if you have more empathy with the families of people who get addicted to things, then you might say no tripling's too much. That's a discussion we could seriously have. And again, worth doing the experiment if you could go back. But if the market even doubled, and we said, okay, that's too much, we're going to go back, we just doubled the size of the drug market that we're fighting the drug war against. That doesn't seem plausible to me.
What about
even if the resulting legal cocaine industry didn't have the political economic power to stop the re-illegalization? So that seems to me chimerical. But again, if the only alternative were our current strategy or something like alcohol, and you said to me, look, from the point of view of poor Black America, another alcohol problem would be preferable to what we've got. I wouldn't necessarily disagree. We just have to agree that we couldn't actually do that. But since I think that we could have most of the benefits of prohibition with a small fraction of the costs, if we did it differently, then I want to campaign for doing it differently, for having fewer dealers in prison, for breaking up the flagrant markets that devastate those neighborhoods, for focusing enforcement on violence, and for getting the heavy users who are criminally active, again, in those largely in those very same neighborhoods, to stop using the power of probation.
Sure. What makes you think that it's possible to break up these open-air markets with new techniques? This is a question that I had, given how difficult that's been so far. I mean, I think we both agree that you could mow down every single... That's a terrible way of putting it. You could remove every single person who was standing on a corner there, and a week later, there would be a whole bunch of new people. It's a decentralized industry. You take away a leader, there are new leaders who come in. It's all very Al-Qaeda. And so what could be done to break up something that's been so resistant for 35 years to even creative law enforcement?
I don't think there's been nearly as much creative law enforcement at the in the retail drug markets as there could have been. And I have to partly disagree with what you just said. Because there are two slightly different propositions. One is if there are 20 dealers in the market and you arrest one of them every week, at the end of 20 weeks, there will be 20 dealers in the market, right? Because they'll be replaced. So that's the sense in which you can arrest everybody and nothing changes.
Right.
If you arrested all 20 of them on the same day, so that when the buyers came, there weren't any sellers that day, and you kept that true for 3 weeks, then a new seller could show up and he wouldn't have any customers. So part of the argument is that, that a an open drug market is a focal point in the shelling sense. It's a phenomenon that exists only because people expect it to exist. I want to go there to buy because that's where the sellers are. I want to go there to sell because that's where the buyers are.
Let me try to understand. The people, after 3 weeks, though, are now getting their fix from some now even luckier buyers a bus ride away, right? Who now
depends
have all their business that they had before, right?
Well, it depends. In the places where it's been done, like High Point and East Hempstead, and to some extent Seattle, and also in New York where they did it the other way, just sort of arrested everybody in sight, and, you know, New York has a lot of cops.
Right.
My understanding is that New York drug dealing is now mostly not flagrant, that it's mostly home delivery. That means the buyers are still getting their drugs, at least the sophisticated ones are, but the neighborhood isn't suffering from the dealing or from the mass arrests.
Right.
So, yes, it's very hard to eventually get in between people who really want cocaine and their cocaine. It's not very hard to force dealing into a less socially destructive mode, if that's what the enforcement's about. If you tell law enforcement, your job is to make sure that nobody can buy drugs, you've given them a fool's errand. And they'll just keep arresting everybody in sight because that's the only thing they know how to do. The places where these, David Kennedy calls them drug market interventions, have been tried, apparently they've worked.
So the idea and is to basically tell the characters in the HBO series The Wire, to give us an image. The idea is to tell them, you have to start doing this more like the white kids in Scarsdale, or more like the creative people driving cars around in Manhattan where you can go downstairs and get your drugs delivered. The idea is to tell them, you can keep making your money, but this business of the corner is what has to stop because it's destroying communities. You're saying that there could be a nationwide effort to reshape drug selling such that it was less destructive on communities, and that would be an alternative. That's interesting.
Right. Well, but there's two slightly different versions of this, right? There's the explicit message to the dealers, and there's the implicit message. The explicit message is not the one you said. The explicit message is, okay, you 16 guys, you are the drug dealers in this on this corner. We've identified all of you. We've bought from all of you. We have the video. We could put any of you in prison tomorrow. So the message to you is stop. You're out of business. You're not dealing here. You're not dealing anywhere. Nobody else is dealing here. And by the way, there are some social services and community support available if you'd like to actually try to find a job, get rid of your tattoos, get your teeth fixed, whatever else you need.
Mm-hmm.
You can be very service intensive for 16 guys.
Mm-hmm.
The message to the larger drug market is, look, if you guys want to keep selling drugs to customers, you better do it in a way that doesn't wreck the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not as if you're expecting the guys on that corner to become the guys with the beepers.
Okay.
You're saying to them, fella, crime is no longer an option for you.
Uh-huh.
For you personally.
Uh-huh.
So find something better to do.
Well, let's go into that a bit. The idea, you said social services, and I'm sure you have the same feeling worried about that term, because one has a nagging sense that in the world that we live in, and apparently you're going to live in for a while, they tend not to work. So here's this guy who needs dental work. He might be addicted to something himself. He dropped out of school in 11th grade. And the idea is you tell him, you can't do this anymore. You know, we could send you up the river. We're not going to do that, but we're going to send you to some counseling. And the counseling is going to make him such that he can hold down a job, that he can submit to authority, that he can show up on time, and that he will not drift back out into the streets one town over or something like that. So your idea is that we would have to beef up those social services.
Well, I share your skepticism.
I'm trying not to sound skeptical.
No. But look, I you know, whenever somebody says social services, I reach for my wallet. The drug market interventions, like the HOPE program, do not inflict services on anybody.
Mm-hmm.
There's no you have
That's
to
Hawaii,
go to
X. Right? The Hawaii program?
The Hawaii program, which is now operating in some other places, which says to probationers, you have to stop using your drug, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
Not you have to go to treatment. You have to figure out a way to stop using.
Mm-hmm.
Turns out 80% of them do. Right? So this is more successful than any drug treatment program.
Is it
in getting people
God?
To stop using methamphetamine.
Is there a religious component to it?
No.
Okay.
It's the religion of staying out of jail.
Right.
The program consists entirely of the judge saying, look, you're going to be randomly drug tested.
Mm-hmm.
Every time you're dirty, you're going to spend some time in jail.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that most people aren't that committed to whatever their drug is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're committed enough so that they'll do stuff that was certain to wind them up in prison 5 years from now.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not committed enough to want to be in jail tomorrow. They've got things to do tomorrow.
Sure.
And I'm not at all, it's not necessary to the success of a drug market intervention that all of those 16 people turn their lives around.
Not all of them, yeah.
Some are going to wind up in prison.
Mm-hmm.
What's necessary is that nobody be dealing in that neighborhood, which is now restored to the use of the neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can move on to the next neighborhood. There's no constant that says there have to be lots of flagrant open drug markets in a city. That's a variable.
What's interesting about this is that it seems like this is a possible alternative. If HOPE can be replicated to scale and in some of the really toughest places. And I'm not trying to sound skeptical at all. I'm not. I'm
right.
hopeful, so to speak.
Right.
That would be an alternative to the only thing I've been able to see, which is that the only way to get a representative number of these particular young men working, who have grown up watching their peers not working, it's perfectly reasonable, they're not bad people, but the only way to get them to get on that old-style working track would be if there were no other way to eat than basically appealing to their human nature rather than reasoning them into it. But what you're saying is that there's indication that you can reason a representative, not all of them, but a representative number of people into doing the right thing. That's great information to have.
Well, reason and threaten.
Right.
You know, it's reasoning with a stick.
Yeah.
It's my belief, I don't have data for this, that if you put people on drug testing, and then the probation office job developer goes to employers and says, look, I've got some guys for you. Yeah, they've got felony records. But we certify them drug-free, and by the way, they have to show up at work on time every day or they go to jail.
Mm-hmm.
Their difficulty finding a job would diminish.
Sure.
And I think they would find themselves capable of actually doing a job if that, as you say, that were the only alternative.
I've seen that in some prisoner reentry programs that I was looking at in the New Jersey area some years ago. And I came away thinking, one, everybody who's done any time in prison should come into one of these programs, but politically that's very hard to do, as is being shown in Newark right now. And two, to the extent that everybody who was in prison wasn't coming into one of those programs, I actually watched some of them clearly on their way to going back onto the streets. And I'm not trying to make it sound like I was on the streets watching these things happening like a journalist for years at a time, but I happened to catch a few examples of people who clearly were thinking it would be easier for me to go back to the life, so to speak, than to endure all of these speeches about how I need to keep my nose to the grindstone and go, you know, mow the lawn or to work in the toilet paper factory or wherever you have to start. And that worried me, because I knew that the ones I saw were not exceptional. They were rules, just like the ones who were. But despite this prisoner reentry phenomenon I've seen, I wanted to ask you something based on what I think the response of a lot of people is going to be to the book. You go through it, you know, page by page or chapter by chapter, and I get, based on many of the things that are said, a sense that there are technological interventions we can do in terms of addiction that have not been tried enough, partly maybe because of ideology, partly maybe because of money, and that these things are mentioned as something that we should pay more attention to, but it makes a lot of people wonder, it made me wonder, why can't we go the legalization route, with the idea being that if there's going to be this uptick or this upsurge in addiction, that we could address that with, for example, these substitute opiates and other things that seem to be increasingly effective in terms of what the studies you mentioned are showing, in terms of helping people to get off of these drugs. Why not that pathway?
Okay, so a couple of distinctions here. There's technology in the sort of engineering sense,
mm-hmm.
right? So there's opiate substitution as a technology for getting people not to use the illicit opiates. There's not much progress in that field. The National Center on Drug Abuse has spent the better part of $1 billion looking for some medication for stimulant dependency.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a dry hole. And they're continuing to drill, but I think there's very good reasons to think it's a dry hole. With the opiates, we never got people to stop wanting the opiates. We just provided a substitute.
Mm-hmm.
There's good reasons to think that won't work for the stimulants, because stimulant demand tends to be kindling rather than satiating.
Mm-hmm.
Right? First thing a new man wanted was more cocaine.
Mm-hmm.
So if you gave people a little bit of cocaine, there's no reason to think that that would decrease their desire for still more.
Mm-hmm.
The way a little bit of heroin somewhat satiates the desire for heroin.
Okay.
Or a little bit of opiates satiates the desire.
Okay.
So the other technology is social technology.
Right.
Right? So hope is a process that says to somebody, look, we're going to know whether you use drugs, illicit drugs,
mm-hmm.
and if you did, you're going to have a consequence right away.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, that requires, you know, careful technical thinking about how to actually deliver that.
Mm-hmm.
And when you do, yes, it turns out you can change behaviors, people's behavior, pretty painlessly. Most people don't have to spend more than one or two short stays in jail to figure out that the judge really meant it.
Right.
And then turn around their drug use.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd like to know more than we do know about how much that means in terms of their turning around the rest of their lives.
Mm-hmm.
What we know is that they're less than half as likely to go to prison,
mm-hmm.
if that's done as if they're on routine probation.
Sure.
So yes, at that level there is technology that we could be using. There's technology of drug law enforcement,
mm-hmm.
in the drug market intervention form,
mm-hmm.
and all based around concentration.
Mm-hmm.
So what would it look like if we legalized? Big upsurge in use,
mm-hmm.
Depending in part on taxes, on regulations, on whether it was a free market or a government monopoly.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of limitations do we let people put on their own drug use?
Mm-hmm.
So one option is to say, okay, we're going to legalize cocaine, but you have to decide when you get your cocaine license how much you're going to allow yourself every month.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll have to swipe your card every time you buy.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, you hit your quota.
Mm-hmm.
Don't know if that would work, but you know, Sweden had it for alcohol for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently with some success.
Mm-hmm.
But you can imagine saying, look, if you get a cocaine problem, that's really your problem. Until you commit a crime,
mm-hmm.
in which case it's our problem and you're on the HOPE program and you can't use cocaine because you'll go to jail every time you do.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's an alternative.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think would satisfy the legalizers very much.
No.
And I think the people whose family members got cocaine problems wouldn't be very cheerful about that.
More that second thing. It's interesting, though. Everything that you're saying makes perfect sense, and it's very stimulating to me, this discussion has been. But I'm having a hard time, and this may just be because of human predilection and just what has made sense to me for so long. I have a hard time not thinking about welfare reform in 1996,
mm-hmm.
where we were talking about a population of women who often had been on welfare for generations. And welfare, of course, is a wonderful thing. Society should have a safety net. But the mm-hmm. idea of it becoming a lifestyle where nobody was concerned whether or not you got a job was
right.
something many people had questions about. I certainly did. And it was said that if welfare was limited to 5 years or 3 years, that we couldn't be sure, and a lot of the data reminded me of the very sensible but hardly smoking gun data that we have on this issue of the upsurge in addiction. It was thought mm-hmm. that women would be shivering on subway grates and there would be
right.
this massive crisis. And the fact is, and many of the people who said that were perfectly reasonable, genuinely concerned people. They were not ideologues.
Right.
It turned out that wasn't true, and I think I've been profoundly ideologically affected. This is what gets me called conservative as opposed to the liberal that I think I am.
Mm-hmm.
I was affected by seeing that the women, once it was that way, they got jobs.
Right.
And the stories aren't always beautiful, and they're never going to be rich or even what we would call middle class, but they got jobs, and the data are not perfect, but it's good for somebody to grow up with
right.
somebody who has a job. So here I'm thinking, well, what other way would there be to get these men to get jobs? It seems like
mm-hmm.
such a perfect analogy. And it's hard to let go of that, despite the things that you're saying about the dangers in society of addiction and how that addiction would keep many people from getting jobs anyway. And so, is there anything, have you thought about that with the welfare reform analogy in terms of how legalizing drugs would fit into that kind of thing?
Right. In the welfare reform case, we did a lot of experimentation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to see what the analog would be
mm-hmm.
In this area. There are claims that Portugal and the Netherlands represent experiments in drug legalization, and they really don't.
No. Decriminalization.
Right. Now, in the Netherlands, right, the sale of cannabis is more or less legal.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a limited impact.
Right.
And that suggests to me that legalizing cannabis is probably a reasonable thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't like to see a commercial market. I'd rather let people grow their own or have co-ops.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, if I had to choose between today's cannabis problem with tens of thousands of people in prison
mm-hmm.
And increased cannabis abuse out of a legal market, I'd probably choose the legal market.
But cannabis is not as hideous in terms of defects, right?
It's not as hideous, and it's also, it's not as prohibited. It's so available now that the increase in consumption would be smaller.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think you could reasonably expect to have taxes that would get the price of legal cannabis to about half the current illicit market price.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that still allows for a big upsurge.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not the 80 or 90% decrease you get in cocaine prices.
Mm-hmm.
So, but again, we could do that. That would be a useful thing to do. I don't think that's going to solve the problem in the neighborhoods we're talking about.
No.
Which is mostly a heroin and cocaine problem.
No.
And I don't see any way out of the heroin cocaine prohibition box without getting us into a serious addiction problem. So
there isn't a single message that you would give, say, President Obama right now in terms of how to address the bloody situation as it is now.
I guess my general advice would be to try to find a morphine-free drug policy.
Mm-hmm.
If we can get the sort of culture war out of drug policy
mm-hmm.
and treat it as a practical problem,
mm-hmm.
I think we can find reasonably practical solutions.
Mm-hmm.
But that's easier for me to say than it would be for the president to say.
Seems like we need to really think about what law enforcement does in these cases, and not eliminating
right.
its role, but a major transformation
right.
in what they're doing.
And I think the answer has to be, we send law enforcement back to the job of protecting public safety and order. We stop asking it to do the job of protecting public health and morals by making drugs unavailable. We've given our cops a completely impossible errand. And it's not their fault they're frustrated in doing it.
No, it's not the cops' fault at all. That's something that I've always felt. They get a bad rep. They're doing their job. It's their job that must be reconceived. Well, Mark, this has been very enlightening. I like hearing myself a different way of looking at things than what I'm accustomed to. And your way of looking at things doesn't lend the emotional score that I think it lends to people like me and others of getting rid of the drug war because of its general oppressiveness and being able to stick our finger at the people who tried to create a new prohibition. Nevertheless, if your way actually would be more effective and would make more sense, I'm definitely open to thinking about it, and I learned a lot from the book.
Terrific.
Yeah.
Terrific. So, John, always a great pleasure.
Oh, Mark, say the name of the book that you wrote that you think of as the Desert Island Mark Kleiman work, that actually I think you've been using a lot of the ideas from that one here as well as from the new one.
Right. It's called When Brute Force Fails, How to Have Less Crime and Less Punishment.
That's right. Well, I'm going to get to that one. Thank you very much, Mark.
Terrific. Good. Thanks, John. Take care.
You too.